Hello and welcome to a very different edition of Top of the Progs on Smile Radio, and also in association with and broadcasting on Progzilla Radio. Now, long-time listeners of the show will be quite surprised, as every single show I've ever done since day one back in 2019, I've started and I've talked over a track, and then, you know, I've welcomed everyone into the show, and then I've chatted for a bit and then played some tracks. But I thought this week I would do something slightly different. I've been loving doing the specials recently. You know, we've had a lot of good anniversaries of some classic prog rock albums and tracks. So for this week, I thought it would be fun to do a reverse Room 101 type thing, where I would take a look at some controversial prog rock albums, listen to a track from the album, play it for you all, and then decide whether it should be included and cast into the Room 101, or decide whether it should be saved and we should all enjoy it and listen to it more often. I've got some really, I've got some really interesting picks for you all. The first item on the agenda is Pink Floyd's 1987 album, A Momentary Lapse of Reason. This is a very controversial album, as it is the first Pink Floyd album without Roger Waters. It started out as a David Gilmour solo album. Basically, David Gilmour did a solo album in 1984 called About Face. About Face was a good album, but it didn't really sell that well, and he started work on his next solo album, and he kind of had the idea that maybe it was time to reform Pink Floyd and transform it into a Pink Floyd album. Now, critics of the album will say that A, Roger Waters is not present, B, David Gilmour he's not really a songwriter, or he wasn't at this point. He would come up with riffs and chord sequences, but the actual songcraft was not Gilmour's strong suit, so he would bring in external songwriters and collaborators to work on the tracks. And C, Nick Mason is barely on it. Nick Mason is only really doing sound effects, doesn't play much drums on it, and Rick Wright isn't even a member of Pink Floyd at this point. He's back in the band as a session man. He's contributed bits of keyboards here and there, and the production of the album is 80s. It's the most horrendous of all the Pink Floyd productions, in the sense that it's so dated. The only other album that may have aged this poorly in terms of production is Piper at the Gates of Dawn. That one's instantly 60s. This one's instantly 80s straight away. But without further ado, here's a couple of tracks from Pink Floyd's A Momentary Lapse of Reason album. Now, I think it is a solid album, and I'll explain why after we've heard the tracks and argue the case for this album to be kept out of Room 101. So this is Signs of Life, followed by Learning to Fly by Pink Floyd.
Thank you.
So, Momentary Lapse of Reason, you've heard why it's a controversial album, but why should it escape the fate of Room 101? Well, here's the thing. I think regardless of the musical content on the album, which, by the way, those two songs are fantastic, apart from Signs of Life, it's a little bit of a rip-off of Shine On You Crazy Diamond. I think apart from that, regardless of the musical content on the album, the greatest strength of A Momentary Lapse of Reason was it allowed Pink Floyd to tour again. That was the most important thing on the album. They had not done a tour at this point since the Animals album. They'd not done a big tour. The Wall was such a big show. It was static. It was untourable. They did several nights, you know, around the world in like arenas and stuff with The Wall, but they couldn't really tour with it because it was such a big show and technology was so limited at the time. But with A Momentary Lapse of Reason, they were able to tour. These were the biggest tours they'd ever done. They were playing the biggest venues they'd ever done. You know, they had the screen behind them. They had an army of session players. You had Tim Renick helping out David Gilmour on guitar. John Carin helping out Rick Wright on keyboards, and also the guy who jumps a lot and plays all the percussion on the live videos. I think his name's Gary Wallace as well. But yeah, you had the army of session musos, and for the first time ever, like, they were able to recreate the sounds of the albums note for note on stage, and in a lot of cases, even better than they were in the 70s. You see, in the 70s, it was just Pink Floyd, and occasionally they had Dick Parry, and then later on they had Snowy White, an extra rhythm guitarist, but technology had advanced to such a point where they had the massive light show in the 80s, and when people think of a Pink Floyd live show, they think of the ones in the 80s, the ones that have been captured on film, those incredible moments. So I think A Momentary Lapse of Reason deserves to escape the fate of Room 101 solely because it allowed Pink Floyd to tour the world again. Now, next up on the controversial albums list is an album, funnily enough, titled Drama by Yes. I think you're all familiar with this album. We've all listened to it a few times, and I have some fresh, interesting perspectives on Drama. See, I feel like where the album went wrong. So for those who don't know, Drama is the album. It's Yes, except without John Anderson and without Rick Wakeman. And in their place is producer Trevor Horn and keyboardist Jeff Downes, both from the band The Buggles. So basically, you have this kind of augmented Yes, basically. But it's a very Marmite album, funnily enough, kind of similar to Tales from Topographic Oceans in a way, in that you either love the album and regard it as a masterpiece, or you hate it and you never listen to it. Funnily enough, a few years ago, Yes did a Topographic Drama tour where they played both albums in full, and that must have been quite exciting. But I've been listening to the Drama album a lot recently, and I believe it to be one of Yes's best albums because they were progressing and changing with the times. This is one of my favourites off the album. This is Does It Really Happen by Yes.
treasure, live by the gun. Heritage for son and daughter, down to the slaughter, up for the fun. Up for anything.
See, I really like that. I think one of the best things about the Drama album, why it should avoid the fate of Room 101 and should be kind of embraced as a classic, is because it is a progressive album. You know, I feel like progressive rock is a very strange genre in that bands are expected to progress to a certain point and then just make albums in the kind of same style. And I think Yes kind of were guilty of that maybe a little bit in the 70s. They did they progressed up to Going for the One, and then they did Tomato, which was just a mess, and they were running out of ideas. You know, they were just trying to replicate the success of their earlier work, and then comes Drama, and you know, they were, I think, having Trevor Horn and Jeff Downes in the band really kind of revitalized the Yes machine, because you had the two members who were key figures in the punk kind of new wave and kind of synthesizer pop. The synthesizer sounds on the album are very contemporary compared with what had gone before with the Yes, the Widley Mini Moogs and the Hammond organs. The synth sounds very contemporary, very kind of modern for its time, and it's got a kind of very different sound to the whole album. And I feel like having those guys in the band really kind of pushed them to embrace what was going on. You know, punk had happened, and they kind of took it in the stride. Steve Howe was having more distortion on his guitar, and I think the Drama album is a fabulous album. I think it's slowly becoming one of my favourite Yes albums. I didn't discover it till maybe earlier this year. So how long have I been listening to Yes? Maybe 7 years. It took me 7 years to finally get onto Drama, but I absolutely love it. So next up on the controversial album list, as all conversations about prog rock eventually come back to one band from Charterhouse, and that band is Genesis. I think we already know which album I'm going to be talking about. The one that gets skipped over in Genesis documentaries. There was the massive Genesis documentary called Genesis Together and Apart, or Some of the Parts or something. It was on BBC Two. It was like a 90-minute feature. They basically got the classic lineup, the classic five, back together in the same room to sit down and chat about Genesis, and they talked through the history of the band. And it is a fabulous documentary. It's absolutely fabulous. It's a wonderful watch. But they skip over one important era of Genesis. They do the We Can't Dance 1991, and then they're like, oh, and then nothing happened. And then in 2007, they got back together for a tour. Well, let me tell you, in 1996, Phil Collins leaves Genesis. Banks and Rutherford decide that for some, I've never understood why they wanted to carry on. This is the most baffling thing about that era of the band, is that Banks and Rutherford wanted to carry on with Genesis. I just don't get it. Why, you know, they've done it all. Why would you want to carry on with a different singer as well? Why did they want to keep... This part of it, I can't fathom. They lost the kind of the rhythmic groove and the soul of Genesis, and they produced the Calling All Stations album. But however, I believe under a different name, the album would be remembered as a classic and would be really successful. If this was an album by the duo of Banks plus Rutherford, it would be regarded as a great album, because it is a great album. It's just not Genesis in any kind of way whatsoever. And the title track of the album is one of my favourite Genesis songs, which I'm going to play for you now. This is Calling All Stations by Genesis.
I remember all the moments that I wasted in my life.
baffling that it fades out at that point. That's the only thing I don't like about that song, is it fades out way too early. The live versions are far, far superior to the studio version. But I love it. You know, it's a great song. It's kind of astructural. The structure isn't particularly obvious. It's kind of verse, pre-chorus, then verse again, then chorus, I guess, and then the long instrumental bridge, and then verse and chorus, but a slightly differently arranged version of the chorus at the end. It's a really clever song when you kind of get down into the bones of it. The chords on it are just wild. I think it's one of Banks's finest achievements, as is, I think it's one of Rutherford's finest achievements. That guitar solo is just brilliant. I just absolutely, the kind of the tone of the guitar is so compressed. You can tell he's just turned everything up to 10, gain max, compression 10, and he's come out with something really special. I just absolutely love that. It's such a great listen. This next one is, I'm not really sure where this one lies. You know, I mean, you know, my perspective on these albums is quite different, because I will shock some listeners now. I was born in the year 2001, so, you know, this was, all these albums released 30 plus years before I was born, so it's kind of difficult for me to give a good perspective on what it was like when the album was released at the time. I mean, I can read about the controversy surrounding an album and things like that, but of course, I wasn't there. You know, I can't say these things for certain. I'm just kind of going off what I've read and what I've spoken to other prog rock fans about. But Jethro Tull basically did an album that was released in 1980 under the name A, basically, and kind of like Momentary Lapse of Reason, it was originally an Ian Anderson solo album. Why it was called, the tapes were marked A because A for Anderson, and Ian Anderson doesn't regret making this album, but he regrets the fact that it's a Jethro Tull album, because it's so different to the Tull material that had gone before. But I really enjoy it, and we've got a special guest on the album, as we have Eddie Jobson, who was fresh out of UK at this point on keyboards and electric violin. Again, I really enjoy the album A. I think it's got some great tracks on it, and I don't know, really. It's one of those things, with the passing of time, the kind of controversy surrounding these albums kind of disappears. You know, with what we know now and what we have now, the albums after it and preceding it, it doesn't seem kind of like a... Like, to me, it doesn't seem that different from the Tool material that I've gone before. I can just listen to it and think, oh, this is really good and I really enjoy this. But this is one of my favourite songs off the A album. This is Black Sunday by Jethro Tull.
Got passport, credit cards, a plane that I'm catching. Black Sunday falls one day too soon. The taxi that takes me will be moving so quickly. My suitcase is simply too full for the closing. My pants, shirts and kisses all packed in the hurry. Two best-selling paperbacks, clothes and a grand, and no sign of salesperson to whom I might have them. Black Sunday falls
cake of my lethargy down to the gate with the old moon upon me. Yet I'm chased the small immortality born in the minute of my next returning. Impatient feet tapping and cigarette burning. I'm coming one day too soon, soon.
I think the flute obviously links it to Jethro Tull, but again, that's Ian Anderson's own thing, and I think, you know, would it have sat right as an Ian Anderson solo album? I honestly don't know. I think there is something inherently Tull about it, and obviously that is the presence of Ian Anderson, so it's a bit of a contradiction there, but I really enjoy that song, and I think the album is definitely underrated. I don't think Ian should regret it putting it out as a Jethro Tull album, because if he should regret that, David Gilmour should definitely regret releasing Momentary Lapse and Division Bell. But again, it allowed the band to do a fabulous tour. There's some great concert footage of Eddie Jobson doing some incredible Bach on the violin mixed with Beret and stuff, which is the Jethro Tull standard, and I think it should escape going into room 101. Now, this next one is kind of a strange one. So, Emerson, Lake and Palmer famously disbanded after the Love Beach album in 1978, and Keith Emerson and Greg Lake in the early 80s wanted to get back together, and they spoke to Carl Palmer, and Carl said, "No, I'm busy being mega successful with my new band, Asia. I don't want to do it, but if you guys want to do something, go right ahead." So they found a drummer with a similar last name, one Cozy Powell. Completely different drumming style, by the way. And they recorded an album called E.L. Powell, which is, without a doubt, one of the worst prog rock albums ever made. It's worse than Love Beach. There's no question. You know, it's just the production, the sound is so 80s. Keith Emerson and Greg Lake have kind of lost their muse a little bit. It just doesn't feel kind of the same way. But on the album, there was a classical adaptation of one of the mightiest classical pieces of all time. And in true E.L. Powell fashion, there is a drum solo in the middle of it. And I believe this classical adaptation is so, so good that it means the album should be purged from, should be kept out of room 101 and kept kind of in the prog rock consciousness. This is a live version, and It's a slow burner, but my goodness, close your eyes, turn your speakers up, listen to some incredible classical music along with a brilliant drum solo. This is Mars, the Bringer of War, along with Cozy Powell's drum solo, live by Emerson, Lake and Powell. I love that. That is, it requires so much patience to listen to. It's so tense, so dark, and so horrific. I think the studio version fails a little bit in the fact that, of course, it was done in the studio. You know, it's got... It just doesn't work as well as a studio composition in the... It's kind of hard, isn't it? Because, like, the orchestral versions of Mars were performed in front of an audience, and I feel like you need that. You know, I don't know if I mentioned that by Gustav Holstrom as the Planet Suite from 1918 or thereabouts. But, yeah, there's something magic about that. And the fact that it's just three people, I feel like technology advanced to a point with synthesizers that they could do something amazing there, and I just really enjoyed it. I hope you all enjoyed that one as much as I did. I was literally on the edge of my seat during the whole 12 minutes. Anyway, we're now unfortunately nearing the end of this very different show. What did you think of the show? You know, put a comment in the live chat. Did you enjoy the new format, the kind of new special? I might do some more of these in the future. I'm going to close now with a little bit of controversial King Crimson, one of my favourite tracks from the band's controversial second album, In the Wake of the Poseidon. This is Cadence and Cascade by King Crimson. Thank you all for listening. I hope you have a good week. Goodbye.
Cadence and Cascade kept a man named Jade cool in the shade while his audience played. Purred, whispered, spend us to we only serve for you. Sad paper caught to sound.